Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, October 28, 2015. We don't want a World War III. That's the Jonas Brothers, and their idea of World War III is a domestic dispute, but I'm more concerned about mission creep in Syria and Iraq. And yesterday, in an appearance before the Senate Armed Services Committee, the Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, just kind of blandly stated that we are retooling our strategy in Iraq and Syria, and we will conduct unilateral ground raids if needed to target Islamic State militants. Carter didn't say under what circumstances the U.S. will conduct more ground action, but he said, once we locate them, no target is beyond our reach. We won't hold back from supporting capable partners in opportunistic attacks against the Islamic State or conducting such missions directly, whether by strikes from the air or direct action on the ground. Now, I rarely say I told you so, or quote myself, or say I predicted this. But frankly, I have been predicting this for some time now. And it appears that the American people are sufficiently distracted, complacent, unconcerned about the extension of the combat mission in Afghanistan, despite the fact we said that it's over. And with the lame duck status of the Obama presidency, they're moving forward to commit the United States to more military action in this incoherent, unimaginable clusterfuck. And I do apologize again if that term offends you, but I find nothing else really conveys the sheer ludicrous complexity of this conflict, the incoherent American approach, and the failure of our leaders to really stand up and talk rationally about it. Now, yesterday, Lindsey Graham was blistering in his attacks on the administration. He wants a full ground war with a major deployment of U.S. forces. And he he seems unmoved by the complexity of the situation, the idea that this could be the early skirmishes of a world war with Russia, now deeply involved in Syria. And while hawks like Lindsey Graham have a lot of free advice for the White House and the president, they're not willing to debate these issues in the Congress in the context of a war powers resolution. They continue to throw money at Obama and have no objection to how he spends it on these military misadventures. And they hector him from the cheap seats. But their own failure to live up to their constitutional duty is quite obvious. Now, the one good bit of news in this mess is that Iran has agreed to join some talks in Vienna between the U.S. and Russia over the conflict in Syria. And I think this is good. I believe in diplomacy over military action. Most people, even the experts, acknowledge that there isn't a military solution to this mess in Syria. And so the Iranians, in some ways emboldened by the nuclear deal that is now finalized, have agreed to join these discussions. And with their influence with both Russia and Syria, I think this is a good sign. Now, Anthony Blinken, Deputy Secretary of State, is quoted in a French newspaper saying he hoped that Iran could play a positive role in supporting a political transition in Syria. And the New York Times quotes Hossein Mousavian, a former Iranian diplomat, nuclear negotiator who now teaches at Princeton. And he said, I'm not surprised because leader Khamenei had said that if the deal were done fairly, the Iranian nuclear deal, with face-saving for all parties, Iran would agree to next steps on other issues. This is a big step forward. Mousavian added, there are practically speaking two coalitions, one established by the U.S. with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and the other coalition established recently with Russia, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Hezbollah. A resolution of the Syria crisis is impossible, he said, unless all major regional powers and international powers agree to sit down together. Now, I think this is positive. But when you couple it with the clear announcement of mission creep, and I'm going to share with you three different editorial comments regarding this, well, this is just more madness. The New York Times, which is a staid establishment corporate media outlet, is actually most aggressive in criticizing the Obama moves. They open with, and you know, this is some of the most alarming or excitable language that the Times uses in its understated editorials. But it reads, the Obama administration is taking steps to expand a military campaign that remains untethered to any coherent strategy. Instead of challenging an escalation of American military forces in the Syrian war, several prominent members of Congress are irresponsibly demanding even more hawkish approaches. It notes that the administration is considering deploying American ground troops to support local forces that are expected to do the bulk of the fighting and call in airstrikes. And the Pentagon continues to call the military campaign in Syria and Iraq an advise and assist mission, a characterization that was misleading when the campaign began and is now absurd, says the Times. And it doesn't use the phrase mission creep. It says, by incrementally increasing its combat role in a vast, complicated battleground, the United States is being sucked into a new Middle East war. And this is how it happened in Vietnam. And we are just replaying that screenplay. This is another sequel that nobody asked for. This editorial goes on. But before contemplating a more forceful military plan, Congress and the administration must confront the fact that the current one, which includes airstrikes and support for select bands of rebels, lacks a legal framework and an attainable goal. The first problem, the legal framework, could be fixed if the White House and congressional leaders were willing to work together to set clear limits on what the Pentagon is allowed to do. Preposterously, thunders the Times, the military campaign that began more than a year ago and has cost more than $4 billion is still being waged under the authority of the congressional authorization, the blank check, passed after 9/11. And they continue, with few exceptions, lawmakers seem completely unconcerned that they're allowing a president to go to war without formal authorization from Congress. Instead, many are calling on the administration to take even bolder steps that range from establishing a no-fly zone to using American firepower to oust Assad, the Syrian president. And the Times says, at least on those two tactics, the White House appears rightly skeptical. And so what we have is consensus that the Obama administration and the president himself have lost substantial credibility over their senseless moves in Iraq and Syria. Now to The Guardian, where Simon Tisdall wrote a piece headlined, Obama fumbles for credibility in Syria as Russia and Iran seize initiative. And after noting what Ashton Carter has said, that I characterize as mission creep and boots on the ground, Tisdall writes, despite Turkish objections, Washington is considering closer cooperation with Syrian Kurdish militias that have ejected the Islamic State from territory along Syria's northern border. And Tisdall opines, Obama's rethink does not mean he is about to renege on his vow to avoid boots on the ground, despite excitable reports to the contrary. Well, I'm one of those excitable people, because I've seen this before. And it's pretty clear that these trends are hard to reverse. Once you begin escalation and the mission creep is in place, typically incidents occur that cause massive escalation and lead to a much wider conflict. And so Tisdall, while correctly characterizing President Obama, falsely notes that he says Obama declined to attack Assad even after the Syrian president crossed a red line by using chemical weapons. That's not true. In fact, we have even more information that the incident outside Damascus in Ghouta in August of 2013, or was it 2014? I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me. At any rate, we are pretty confident now that Turkey supplied that chemical weapon to one of the rebel groups in an effort to get the U.S. to get involved. And so that comment here by Mr. Tisdall seriously undermines his credibility, in my view. And finally, there is a commentary piece bylined Ryan Faith at Vice News, and it's kind of a casual, snarky tone to it. And he writes, people make a lot of hay over whether this actually constitutes combat or not, and whether that meant that the U.S. is engaged with boots on the ground, and if that meant that the U.S. was back at war in Iraq. So when Congress was told by Carter on Tuesday that American soldiers would be conducting raids in places including Syria, that must have meant that the U.S. was putting those boots back on the ground and on ground controlled by the Islamic State. So Ryan Faith acknowledges that this is a change in the strategy and in the deployment, but he seems to be okay with it. He says the U.S. most certainly will have special forces guys shooting stuff up, not just in Iraq and Syria too. But it's not the same thing as saying that it's time to pull the quagmire alarm or proclaim the start of yet another big U.S. invasion of the region. Well, I strongly disagree. I think that we are already in a quagmire, and this is the start of another big U.S. deployment. It's very clear that they are setting the stage for a far more robust U.S. involvement there. And I'm warning you, I hope you can process it. Meanwhile, you probably know that there was a major earthquake a week ago in Afghanistan and that hundreds of people were killed. And forgive me, but I don't report much on natural disasters and things like that because the corporate media generally does a decent job at that. And I try to focus on the things that I have something to offer in terms of commentary. But what's interesting is that in the chaos following the earthquake, Taliban insurgents have overrun a district in northern Afghanistan. It's a province called Darkand. The province is Takhar, and the district capital they have seized is called Darkand. And this is just another situation where the Kabul government, even with the support of 9,800 American troops, is unable to control the country. And the idea that keeping our 9,800 or 10,000 troops there a little longer and then a residual force for ever, it simply makes no sense. And once again, we end up overextended and underprepared to deal with the situations at hand. Benjamin Netanyahu continues to provoke the Palestinians, because he has ordered a review of the status of Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. And this could potentially strip tens of thousands of Palestinians of their Israeli residency rights. And this is something we've been talking about. The American media, you know, depicts the rounds of violence that have recently occurred as triggered by Palestinians. But there have been many Israeli provocations, including the firebombing of a family in the West Bank. And so the media conveniently picks markers or entry points to a particular episode, and it's quite arbitrary. But despite the efforts of Secretary of State Kerry to get Netanyahu to stop his verbal provocations, He doesn't, and I think that that is intentional, at least in my opinion. Now, here in California, there is a struggle over the right of citizens, students, and staff at the University of California to criticize the state of Israel. And I'm very concerned about this. We've talked about it before. The Center for Constitutional Rights published a report a couple of weeks ago about the widespread chill. They cited 65 college campuses across the country where those who have spoken up in support of the Palestinians have been rather brutally treated, and their free speech rights are not honored. And so we have a double standard where commentary that is pro-Israel is permitted. Commentary that is critical of Israel is not. And I told you recently that the UC Board of Regents, that's the trustees who run the university system here in California, have been wrestling with a proposal that would permit those who are accused of anti-Semitic comments, and that definition is what really is at issue here, could be suspended, expelled, or in the case of an instructor or a faculty member, they could be fired. And this is being advanced by Richard Blum, who is the husband of Senator Dianne Feinstein. And it is extremely ugly in its current form. Now, that particular proposal has been tabled, and they have assigned a new committee to work on this, not because it was offensive or too offensive, but because supporters of Israel have criticized it for being insufficient. And I find this truly alarming. And it shows the outsized power and influence that the Israel lobby has in this country. Now, I'll continue to watch this and report on it for you. But it's just another loss of constitutional rights under the first 10 amendments that we're seeing right before our eyes. Every day I pause to thank people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast, like David Michalitz, who just took out a new annual subscription. Thank you, David. Pleasure to have you as a part of our community. Then there's James McCobb, who just renewed his annual subscription. Nick Yaksich, who is a long-time monthly subscriber. And I see that Kyle McClary just opened up a new annual subscription, too. I'm very grateful for this support, and I want to invite you to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. In the upper right corner of our zippy, newly upgraded website, you'll find a button that says Menu. When you click on that, the pull-down will reveal Become a Subscriber, and that's where you click. And you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual subscription. You can make a one-time contribution via PayPal of any amount, or there's a P.O. Box address there you can use if you'd like to send money in the old-fashioned way. I truly appreciate your support, and I also encourage you to share these podcasts with like-minded individuals so that we can grow the audience here and reach more people. Well, this kind of feels like Halloween, and that the ghost of John Yoo has suddenly resurfaced. Because today, the New York Times is publishing a blockbuster story under the byline of Charlie Savage, one of their better reporters, who has dug into an interesting angle on the execution of Osama bin Laden. And it turns out that there were four administration lawyers who were secretly assigned to write a series of memos justifying the killing, not the capture, of Osama bin Laden, justifying the incursion into Pakistani territory, justifying this raid without notifying Congress. Those were just some of the issues that were papered over as these lawyers rationalized this outright assassination by the United States. The parties to this secret legal cabal include the general counsel of the CIA, Stephen Preston, Mary DeRosa, National Security Council legal advisor, Jay Johnson, who was the Pentagon counsel and is now Secretary of Homeland Security, and a former Rear Admiral, I guess retired Rear Admiral, James Crawford. So, weeks before the raid in Abbottabad, they began to meet And they tried to expect or predict what kinds of legal issues would be raised if the raid was successful, and especially if it was not. And so they met secretly. They didn't even tell the Attorney General, we're told. And they reviewed issues like, well, what if we just bomb the compound where we think bin Laden is? Well, that was rejected because non-combatants could be killed and completely innocent people living nearby. Well, that's kind of nice to know. But they examined a lot of these different issues. Like I said, the incursion into Pakistan. And they decided that using a disputed exception to sovereignty, that they could declare Pakistan is unwilling or unable to suppress this threat, even though we had not formally asked Pakistan to do so. So, as I read this, and I have not read their legal briefs, because of course we're not allowed to. They're secret, like John Yoo's memos were for a while. But what's interesting to me is that they wrote a lot of paper here that is truly rationalizations. For example, in deciding not to notify Congress beforehand, the lawyers said that Obama is able to violate international law when authorizing a covert action. And then it turns out that the CIA director at the time, Leon Panetta, had already briefed some top members of Congress without White House permission. So this is an interesting article. I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast so you can read it for yourself. But including the issues related to the reported burial at sea of the corpse of Osama bin Laden, there's still far more questions than answers about this episode. And I think it'll take a long time for us to get to the bottom of it. Dennis Hastert, the former wrestling coach who became Republican Speaker of the House, went into the federal courthouse in Chicago today and entered a single guilty plea to structuring a bank transaction. He was let off the hook on the charge of making false statements to federal investigators, which carried a much longer potential sentence. And as we have disclosed to you and discussed with you, Sybelle Edmonds knows a whole hell of a lot about the dirt in Dennis Hastert's files. And this guilty plea successfully seals the cover-up on much greater crimes that it appears Dennis Hastert has committed. And because, as Speaker of the House, he was engaged in sexual activities that were videotaped not only by American intelligence and the FBI, but also, Sybelle reports, by foreign intelligence agencies. So Dennis Hastert was deeply compromised. He's been, more recently, a lobbyist for the nation of Turkey, and his dirty connections to Turkey are at the center of what Sybelle Edmonds is aching to tell people. And if you go to BoilingFrogsPost.com, you can read her commentaries, you can see the scripts from the podcast that she has produced about this. There's a great deal of detail. And all of this being swept under the rug and locked up possibly forever behind this guilty plea of Dennis Hastert in federal court today. And it's interesting because the New York Times decided to quote a guy named Dick Simpson. And he served as an alderman on the city council in Chicago when I was there in the 1970s. He's a bright guy and was a staunch critic of the original Boss Daily. And Dick Simpson, who is a political scientist in addition to being a former politician, notes the history of the cases like Rod Blagojevich, the former governor, and Jesse Jackson Jr., the former congressman, who were convicted and spent jail time for fraud. And Simpson says cryptically, or whatever, he says, normally you have to uncover the whole crime. And Simpson probably doesn't even know the depths of what he's talking about when it comes to the real crimes of Dennis Hastert. Good news from Alabama, where, like so many other states, the Republican governor and legislature have tried to block funding to Planned Parenthood. But a federal district judge, Myron Thompson, has issued an order directing the state to restore funding to Planned Parenthood because the law they passed didn't have a legal reason to end Medicaid provider agreements with the two Planned Parenthood clinics in the state. This whole vendetta is driven by emotion and by these phony, selectively edited videos about selling baby parts or fetus parts. And it's all bullshit. And it's nice to see that there's a federal judge who can smell it and call it what it is. Bob Bentley, the governor of Alabama, who's now caught up in his own adultery scandal and his wife is divorcing him, nonetheless feels he can pander to the Christian right in his state by pressing on against Planned Parenthood. And my final story today involves Apple Computer, which is late to the game, but they are standing up for our privacy rights. And a federal court judge in New York City, James Orenstein, made a remarkable comment from the bench that seemed to cause the Justice Department lawyers to flinch. So Apple is in court resisting a warrant to unlock the phone of some user who is a suspect in a criminal investigation. Now, the government claims that Apple has been unlocking phones in compliance with search warrants for years without any objection. But it's finally dug in its digital heels and is saying no. Says that to comply with the warrant would threaten the trust between Apple and its customers and substantially tarnish their brand. And so Orenstein said that forcing Apple to comply would be comparable to asking a drug company to administer a lethal injection to a patient despite its conscientious objection, simply because it has the tools in order to do so. Now, in its arguments, Apple made a slightly less inflammatory comparison. They said to hold that the existence of such license is enough to conscript Apple into government service would be to say that the manufacturer of a car that has licensed software in it could be required to provide law enforcement with access to the vehicle or to alter its functionality at the government's request. And Apple argues that the licensing requirements of their software don't entitle the company to invade a customer's privacy to access data stored on my Apple device. Well, better late than never, Tim Cook and Apple Computer. I welcome your support of my privacy rights and your efforts to block the overreach of the government, which seems to believe that the Fourth Amendment and the Bill of Rights is some sort of a quaint historic document that has no relevance, no applicability today. And boy, is that annoying. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you are free to share with absolutely anyone. And I hope you will. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until